Welcome. You're listening to the Gideon Warrior Radio Network. Look for us on TalkShoe.com. Type in keyword Gideon Warrior Network. And you can find us and other Israelite speakers at ChristianAmericanMinistries.com and AngloIsraelTruth.com. Please remember, your free will gifts and offerings help us to continue laboring in the vineyard. Please consider visiting our support page. We thank you for visiting our network and sites. It is our prayer you'll be edified by them. Here's the message, and thanks for listening. This is Part 9 in America's Constitutional Idolatry. In Part 8, we briefly summarized the steps of the propaganda to worship the idol, the statutes, the judgments, and the ordinances, if you will, for worshiping the idol. I briefly took us to an understanding of the Federalist Papers and how the Federalist Papers were used to promote the propaganda, of how the form and function of the idol was to operate, and that is, the idol, the Constitution. In this Part 9, I believe I'll subtitle the message, "The Idol Prevails." To begin the message, I'd like to take us back to chapter 8 in 1 Samuel, and I'm going to begin with verse 10. "And Samuel told all the words of the Lord unto the people that asked of him a king. And he said, This will be the manner of the king that shall reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for himself for his chariots and to be his horsemen, and some shall run before his chariots. He will appoint him captains over thousands and captains over fifties, and will set them to ear his ground, to reap his harvest, and to make his instruments of war, and instruments of his chariots. And he will take your daughters to be confectionaries, and to be cooks, and to be bakers. And he will take your fields, and your vineyards, and your olive yards, even the best of them, and give them to his servants. He will take the tenth of your seed, and of your vineyards, and give to his officers, and to his servants. And he will take your men servants, your maid servants, and your goodliest young men, your asses, and put them to his work. He will take the tenth of your sheep, and you shall be his servants. And you shall cry out in that day, because of your king, which you shall have chosen, and the Lord will not hear you in that day." End the scripture. All right. Now, in Part 8, we concluded and summarized at the very end, I believe it was May 29th, 1790, and it was just 1 year earlier in 1789 that the Constitution was ratified and Washington was sworn in as president, John Adams as vice president. So here we are now in less than 6 months after this has occurred. Secretary of Treasury, Secretary of War, Attorney General, the U.S. Army, the federal district courts in each state, and a Supreme Court were all established. See, as you can see, these are just the beginnings of the agency administration. This is the very thing that God told the children of Israel would come upon them from their king. Now let's look at a little bit of the early history real quick, just arising out of these various agencies. Secretary of Treasury Alexander Levine Hamilton, he wasted no time. He began by monetizing the debt. He began to prepare legislative proposals to establish a central bank and set in motion favorable subsidies of tax revenue to expand America's industry. Now, while many of these plans didn't see the light of day, there can be no doubt there would be many more Hamiltons, and as you all know, there certainly have been. Although by 1795, Hamilton did resign his position, Hamilton's plan to redeem at full face value the bonds and drafts issued to the suppliers and soldiers for the War for Independence was leaked. Yes, leaked. Just like today, this inside information sent the profiteers into motion. Jefferson, who had accepted the post as Secretary of State in 1790, described it thus, quote, "Couriers and relay horses by land, and swift-sailing pilot boats by sea were flying in all directions. Active partners and agents were associated and employed in every state, town, and country neighborhood." and this paper was bought up 5 shillings, even as low as 2 shillings to the pound, before the holders knew Congress had already provided for its redemption at par. End quote. It was Jefferson who would explain to Washington that Hamilton and others were acquiring the right to receive interest on the debt of these bonds and drafts for decades. Hamilton's National Bank Plan, approved by Congress for 20 years, wound up at the Supreme Court as one of the first constitutional challenges the Supreme Court had to grapple with. 3 words in Article 1, Section 8, necessary and proper, needed to be interpreted. The court, with John Jay as Chief Justice, ruled on its strict adherence to the intent of the document and the 25 enumerated powers therein. 135 years later, this court would do away with this strict adherence precedent and pave the way for the New Deal's profligate spending. Jefferson, so incensed by Hamilton's British policies outside of constitutional restraints, resigned in 1793 as Secretary of State after just 3 years. I want you to remember that now. Jefferson, an ardent proponent of this American Constitution, resigned in disgust because of one man and his view on policy and constitutional liberties available in the document, regardless of its original intent. Additionally, I want you to consider, why wouldn't Jefferson fight for the document and seek to remove Hamilton? Well, the answer is, there's no mechanism other than impeachment, but this is only for times of not so good behavior. Unfortunately for Jefferson, Hamilton's adultery would not hit the press until 1797, 2 years after he resigned. Of course, that little indiscretion that he had would certainly not be any grounds for removal today. So already, because of the corruptness of one man attempting to pervert the Constitution's professed intent, Jefferson quits and goes home. Now, don't misunderstand. This is not just some abject condescension, as somebody, you know, playing Monday morning quarterback. He will be called on again to fight as a nominee for president. Now, at this time, political parties were already beginning to grip the nation, in spite of Washington's farewell admonition to avoid them. And, indeed, Christ warned that a house divided cannot stand. Matthew 12:22-28. Speaking to the issue of parties and compensation for office holders, Franklin put the issue out in the form of a question and then provided the answer. Let's look at what he had to say from the Annals of America. Quote, "What kind are the men that will strive for the profitable preeminence through all the bustle of cabal, the heat of contention, the infinite mutual abuse of parties, tearing to pieces the best of characters? It will not be the wise and moderate, the lovers of peace and good order, the men fittest for the trust. It will be the bold, the violent, the men of strong passions and indefatigable activity in their selfish pursuits. These will thrust themselves into your government and be your rulers, and these too will be mistaken in their expected happiness of their situation, for their vanquished competitors of the same spirit and from the same motives will perpetually be endeavoring to distress their administrations, thwart their measures, and render them odious to the people." End quote. Now, if that quote from Benjamin Franklin, the 80-year-old in the room, if you will, this was not in the room there, but think of that quote, in light of what is happening today, we have seen these two political parties do exactly that. Is that certainly we see it from one party more significantly than we do from the other, in terms of how he says this, these will thrust themselves into your government and be your rulers, and these too will be mistaken in their expected happiness of their situation for their vanquished competitors. In other words, the other party, of the same spirit and from the same motives, will perpetually be endeavoring to distress their administration, thwart their measures, and render them odious to the people. And that's exactly what we're seeing today, is not the Republican candidate and the Republican Party constantly being made to be perceived as odious to the people, to thwart the measures, to distress their administration. So certainly Franklin had a window piercing into the current state of this constitutional government and this party system alive and well in America today. So contrast this truth with what the founders wrote into the Pennsylvania Constitution many decades preceding America's Constitution, and note it in relation to parties and salaries. This is from Allison, the real Benjamin Franklin, and I quote, "As every freeman, to preserve his independence, ought to have some profession, calling, or trade, or farm, whereby he may honestly subsist, there can be no necessity for, nor use in, established offices of profit, the unusual effects of which are dependence and servility, unbecoming freemen. Wherefore, whenever a office becomes so profitable as to occasion many to apply for it, the profits ought to be lessened by the legislature." End quote. Now, before we get too far afield, let's remember something just mentioned a bit ago in the chain of events under this new government and constitution. You'll recall that Jefferson resigned as Secretary of State due to Hamilton's incessant attempts at national bank on the order of the Bank of England. But something considered completely outside the limited delegated powers of Article 1, Section 8. But you recall that Congress chartered it for 20 years. And the incentive to Congress in doing so? Well, stock in the bank, of course. Hamilton, a man unable to escape the attractiveness of bribery and corruption so prevalent in England government and throughout creation's historical record, but as in the days of Samuel, 1 Samuel 6 and 8, when justice is perverted, men either stay disposed to suffer while the evils are sufferable, or they seek to alter or abolish this form to which they are accustomed, as was recognized in the Declaration of Independence. In Samuel's day, they sought a king. In colonial America, they sought a constitution. But the Constitution was wholly inadequate to restrain the unbridled passions of men, one man, or a king, just in the same way that God had warned. And such was the case of the National Bank with its newly authorized authority to issue currency. Issue it did, until the flood of this paper currency was far more than was able to be redeemed by gold and silver available. Jefferson quipped, quote, "The bank is so firmly mounted on us that we must go where they will guide," end quote. While Jefferson may have seen this frightful and dreadful bubble about to burst with the future generations left to hold the bag, unbelievably, by 1798, Hamilton saw his own error. And in a letter to Oliver Wolcott, then Secretary of Treasury, also urged a return to the constitutional enumerated power for Congress to coin money and regulate the value thereof. A currency based on the long-standing history of value, gold and silver. However, would such a bank or financial congressional constructed entity be any better? Congress, therefore, would not terminate its existence or function before its 20-year term had run. Now, even though Jefferson had professed these understandings, some might even profess religious or virtuous views, and in spite of the, quote, intense study of the ancient principles, end quote, the ancient principle of usury, as taught throughout Scripture, Exodus 22:25-7, Leviticus 25:35-7, Ezekiel 18:3, Deuteronomy 23:19-20, Psalms 15:5, Isaiah 24:1-3, Jeremiah 15:10, just to name a few, they somehow yet remained elusive. Here's from Allison, the real Jefferson, and I quote, "It is a wise rule never to borrow a dollar without laying a tax in the same instance for paying the interest annualized and the principal within a given term. On such a pledge as this, sacredly observed, a government may always command on a reasonable interest all the lendable money of their citizens," end quote. Now, to ensure the listener is not to allege this question is out of context, or this quote, rather, is out of context, his principal here continues to advocate its repayment of it within 19 years, or a 20-year generation cycle. Now, I would not argue that debts incurred in one generation ought to be paid in that generation. However, the virtue, if you will, on the one hand, cannot and should not ignore the ancient biblical principles specifically concerning interest or usury, which Jefferson twice refers to. Question: why should the citizenry, in a time of war or invasion, lend at usury or interest the money or resources God had provided them to themselves, i.e. the civil administrative government, at interest and usury, or even in a time of peace? Where in the world is this ancient principle of lending upon usury to your own brethren to be found recorded in these ancient principles studied by Jefferson? The simple answer is nowhere. In fact, it is condemned in the harshest of terms. As Ezekiel 18:3 conveys, the man doing such things is detestable and is to be put to death. But I tell you, I've read the writings of some notable and eminent Christian theological doctors, which convey, when the Constitution is restored and the U.S. Treasury established as the constitutional authorized bank, the loans it makes to industry will be of low and modest interest, with profits accruing to the Treasury Department's general fund to cut down on taxes. Excuse me? Is not this therefore a tax via usury to cut down taxes? How does this compute? It is also said branch banks in the states would have the same marvelous system to reduce state taxes. So let's recap the principles found in this thinking. We lend at interest to the businesses of industry of our citizenry, using the gain from this lending to reduce taxes, which of necessity have to be higher than is actually necessary for the goods or services to be used or acquired because the usury was required. Is not the devastation of this concept or the principle not abundantly evident? Should we not rather seek to establish the true ancient principle of the God of perfect order and administration? As for me and my house, let us serve the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, when in 1982 I learned and began to fully understand the intent in the Constitution to prohibit states from accepting anything but gold and silver coin as a payment in tender of debt, Article 1, Section 10, I searched in vain for the amendment of this article and the prohibition on the states. But there was none. It was nowhere to be found. In spite of this knowledge, for another 25 years, I continued to support, if you will, worship, and defend this defective and grossly altered document by justifying my actions through casting my vote for those who would continue to swear to uphold it. And I have since repented of this sin and this worship. Go back to that 1828 dictionary definition of worship and ask yourself, have I been worshiping the Constitution for the United States of America? You can just type in 1828 dictionary on any internet search. You'll get it up. Type in the word worship and look the word up. we really have to take a hard look at repenting of this sin and worship of the creature and not the Creator. Now, I understand this appears a condescension of Jefferson again. It's the fruit which is produced that ought to be condemned, and all men fall prey to various aspects of these things that draw us in. Usury bears no good fruit, and one can only speculate as to why it was disregarded. On this issue of the Constitution's authority to coin money and regulate the value thereof, it would be 100 years of struggle to maintain a stable currency and avoid the evils inherent in paper currency. The Civil War, ostensibly over slavery, would be the impetus for the economic debt conditions. The Panic of 1893 would be the conditioning the people would need to accept what the Congress eventually would do, which was to enact the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. For 20 years, until 1934, the Federal Reserve note was redeemable for gold and silver. The Federal Reserve would use its new power and policy to squeeze from the citizenry of this nation its monetary financial resources and reserves and plunge the nation into abject poverty under the tool known and called the Great Depression. Roosevelt, as one of his first major acts upon ascending the presidency in April of 1933, would declare the people had all the gold and the nation was broke, and that the nation's emergency required he order all gold bullion certificates coinage surrendered to the Federal Reserve Bank, and the people were promised silver certificates redeemable for silver for the value of their gold. Emergency Banking Act H.J.R. 192-10. Just 10 months later, January of 1934, Congress passed the Gold Reserve Act, passing to the Federal Reserve the full ownership of all gold which had been turned in. And under the letter of the act, the gold price was changed from roughly $20 an ounce to $35 an ounce, automatically devaluating the silver certificates just given the people by 40%. Massive wholesale theft of the American people. Little more than three decades later, Johnson, 1968, issued the executive directive terminating silver certificates redemption in silver. And 60 years after the enactment of the Federal Reserve note, the product of the Emergency Banking and Federal Reserve Act was firmly established as legal tender 316-1973. Since then, the purchasing power of a single dollar has lost more than 290%, all without firing a single shot, all without a single vote to amend Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution, or Article 1, Section 8. Now, that in and of itself should make most people's blood boil and do as the Declaration says, to cast off such government, taking new safeguards. But no, the vast majority of the people know nothing about this. And if they knew anything about it, they really would not know what to do about it, because their leaders, their church leaders, have not taught them the laws of God. So you see, ladies and gentlemen, what has occurred is exactly as God prophesied. We have become a bankrupted nation, a servant to the lender, just as God told us we would become, just as He said we would then cry out to Him. Let's go back to 1 Samuel chapter 8, now that I'm thinking about it. 1 Samuel chapter 6, I think it's going to be. And I'm going to flip there, Hill, real quick. Let me see if I can find where I want to go for you. I think it's going to be chapter 11, 12. It's going to be chapter 12. Samuel, 1 Samuel, chapter 12, verse 6. We'll begin there. And we'll conclude this message with these thoughts. And then I have some more thoughts that I want to pick up, basically looking at some of the basic underlying principles which a lot of people do use to advocate, are the principles embodied in the sacred documents of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. So we'll close up here with part 8 on this word of the Lord, 1 Samuel chapter 12, beginning at verse 6. And Samuel said unto the people, It is the Lord that advanced Moses and Aaron, and that brought your fathers up out of the land of Egypt. Now therefore stand still, that I may reason with you before the Lord of all the righteous acts of the Lord which he did to you and your fathers. When Jacob was come into Egypt, and your fathers cried unto the Lord, then the Lord sent Moses and Aaron, which brought forth your fathers out of Egypt, and made them dwell in this place. And when they forgot the Lord their God, he sold them into the hand of Sisera, captain of the host of Hazor, and into the hand of the Philistines, and into the hand of the king of Moab, and they fought against them. And they cried unto the Lord, and said, We have sinned, because we have forsaken the Lord, and have served Balaam and Ashtaroth. But now deliver us out of the hand of our enemies, and we will serve thee. And the Lord sent Zerubbabel, and Bedan, and Jephthah, and Samuel, and delivered you out of the hand of your enemies on every side, and you dwelled safely. And when you saw that Nahash, the king of the children of Ammon, came against you, you said unto me, Nay, but a king shall reign over us, when the Lord your God was your king. Now therefore, behold, the king whom you have chosen, and whom you have desired, and behold, the Lord has set a king over you. If you will fear the Lord and serve him and obey his voice and not rebel against the commandment of the Lord, then shall both you and also the king that reigns over you continue following the Lord your God. But if you will not obey the voice of the Lord but rebel against the commandment of the Lord, then shall the hand of the Lord be against you as it was against your fathers. Now therefore stand and see this great thing which the Lord will do before your eyes. Dropping down to verse 19. And all the people said unto Samuel, Pray for thy servants unto the Lord thy God, that we die not, for we have added unto all our sins this evil, to ask us a king. And Samuel said unto the people, Fear not, you have done this all this wickedness, yet turn not aside from following the Lord, but serve the Lord with all your heart. Turn ye not aside, for then should you go after vain things, which cannot profit nor deliver, for they are vain. For the Lord will not forsake his people for his great name's sake, because it has pleased the Lord to make you his people. Moreover, as for me, God forbid that I should sin against the Lord in ceasing to pray for you, but I will teach you the good and the right way. Only fear the Lord and serve him in truth with all your heart, for consider how great things he's done for you. But if you shall still do wickedly, you shall be consumed, both you and your king. End quote. God has instructed us, in spite of ourselves, if you persist in doing this thing and asking of yourself a king or asking of yourself a constitution, and you formulate it in such a way as to leave out God, to leave out God's laws, which are good for a nation, you will eventually bring the curse upon yourself. Either God himself will bring it upon us, or cause and effect will come upon you. And in many cases, cause and effect does. And often, it is precipitated, if you will, by the righteous hand of God to bring us back to him. And so we cry out. But he says, if you shall still do wickedly, you shall be consumed, both you and your king. So I ask you, America, are you done with your constitutional idolatry? And are you ready to serve your true and only king? I think we'll be able to wrap it up in part 10. But there is something that I did suggest that I would be willing to take on, and that's these liberty amendments that are being bandied about. I may do that and add it to the series later. I'm not prepared to do the study and the research on that at this time. I've got a couple of other messages that I'm working on right now, and I'll put those out, and we'll see how time permits and whether I can get those in. But Suffice it to say, we're on a road to self-destruction or God-ordained destruction. Either way, it's not a good thing. Once again, I remain thankful for the opportunity to minister unto those of the New Covenant, as Hebrews 8:8 informed us of. This is Doug Nelson, trusting you will hear these words one day. Well done, thou good and faithful servant.